Good afternoon. We have, I should say in advance that there's been a few technical problems, as there often are, with the images, and they may not come up in the position where they're supposed to be. They managed to jumble themselves up. Now, first of all, can you hear at the back? Is that all right? And you promise me, will you, that if you can't hear, that you'll raise your hands and encourage me to speak up. So let's just start here with the apology for if the images aren't in order. I grew up looking at this portrait of Richard Schomburgk, the explorer and botanic garden director who arrived in Adelaide in 1849. And I'd like to acknowledge help from many of the people in the University of Adelaide, including some fantastic librarians who are here today, who helped turn the thesis, which was huge, into the book, which is lighter and nicer to look at. And there's also help. There's been help from the History Trust, that is financial grants and so on, the Fred Johns biography scholarship from this university, and much help from the Botanic Gardens board and staff. The help from librarians goes back to the 1980s when I was doing a PhD on Schomburgk and found that I could access material that had been acquired over many decades. And some in those days, there were little slips in the back of books. And a couple of books I found I was the first recorded borrower since the 1920s. And the only borrower since the 1920s. So they'd been collecting things for a long time in the field of history of science, although it wasn't taught at the university. But how did Schomburgk get into his career in science? In the 1840s, there weren't science degrees as we know them. If you had an interest in science and you were wealthy, like Charles Darwin, you might become a gentleman scientist. But a significant group of young men started their career by joining an expedition of exploration. Schomburgk was the third son of an assistant Lutheran pastor in Saxony, which was by then part of Prussia. The eldest boy went into the family business, the second was sent to university, and the third, Richard, as the third son, was apprenticed as a gardener. Now, at the time, this was a good choice for the pastor, a prudent choice, because it offered good career opportunities at a time when German gardeners had a very good reputation throughout Europe. And German scientific and technical education at this time was greatly respected in places such as Britain. Richard, who was born in 1811, had completed a period of military service and was working as a gardener in Berlin in the late 1830s when his older brother Robert was asked to lead a British expedition of exploration to British Guiana, which was then Britain's only colony in South America. Robert went to the United States, or he had gone already to the United States as part of his commercial career, in which he didn't do terribly well, I've got to say, but he did some excellent mapping in the West Indies and in British Guiana. And Richard was asked to join this new expedition to British Guiana, which is known as the Boundary Expedition, because they were to set the boundaries through their mapping. And he was to go on behalf of the Prussian government as historian and collector for scientific institutions in Berlin. So this is Richard going on behalf of the Prussian government, and Robert is leading the expedition on the part of the British government. Richard goes as protege of the great Alexander von Humboldt, a figure of huge importance in 19th century science, meticulous in his preparations for his own South American expedition, but also someone with a hugely broad, by our standards, amazingly broad approach to science at a time where one man could cover all areas of science. Hard to believe today. If, as someone from a family of only moderate means, you returned to Europe with your collections and wrote them up, your name could be made. But it was immensely dangerous. Many young explorers died. And right at the very beginning of the British expedition, before they'd even left Georgetown, Richard got yellow fever and only just survived. He was one of the few Europeans known in Georgetown to survive the usually fatal black vomit stage of yellow fever. He must have been extremely strong. And to my mind, the portrait of him as a young man, if that comes up, shows the marks of the physical hardships of the expedition. No, that's when he's older. We'll see if it comes up. He'd had malaria. There were insects called shigos that burrowed under your toenails and had to be cut out. Then for weeks he had to wear makeshift sandals after his boots collapsed, because he'd worn his boots in the river because of the risk of piranhas chewing off your toes, which happened to one of the lads on the expedition. And they had very little food at times when supplies ran out, one of the party died of snake bite. So there were great risks, but there were great compensations. And in 1842, he first saw the remarkable Victoria water lily. Oh, there we are. So we're getting the lily. And that's taken in Guyana in the current period. So he saw the Victoria water lily that we know as Victoria amazonica. Older brother Robert had found specimens on his own first expedition to Guyana that began in 1839. And the lily came to be known as Victoria regia, in honour of the young Queen Victoria, with a few grumbles from the botanists that were sorted out. The Queen didn't approve of Amazonica as a name, so it wasn't used. Descriptions were published in scientific journals and newspapers. Robert sent back seeds to Europe, but no one could get it to grow to well into 1849. Now, the image that we used on the cover is from the 12 views, this sort of rare set that is held by the Barr Smith. The Victoria is one of a whole host of amazing tropical plants that just entranced him. I don't think he ever got over the excitement of seeing these plants, but collecting them and storing them, whether it were live plant seeds or pressed specimens, and getting them safely back to Europe was a nightmare. He had only a few sealed Wardian cases to take live plants back. Many plant specimens had to be dried between dry papers, and keeping them dry in wet tropical weather was extremely hard. Other disasters with specimens arose because some rat had sold him faulty preserving spirits for his little zoological specimens, and it went off. They had to travel much of the time in little canoes, and this image gives you some of the idea of the problems of keeping specimens intact when you're travelling this way. With sparse European settlement, they were entirely dependent on the help of local people that today we call Amerindians. There were many different tribes, and they each had their own customs. One of the tasks for Richard and the expedition artist was to record their appearance, dress, customs and so on, as it was feared, correctly, that some tribes would not survive. You had to learn how to behave so as to be accepted. The custom might be that the local chief would ignore you at first, perhaps for several days. You might be offered food or drink that looked and tasted revolting to a European, but to refuse it was to insult your host. And some of your guides might just disappear overnight if they decided that part of the trip was too dangerous. My guess is that if he managed to negotiate his way around British Guiana with all these problems, in his later career here in Adelaide, dealing with politicians and community leaders in colonial Australia would be a cinch. But we'll see that some of his contemporaries in Australia found this task rather more difficult. In 1844, older brother Robert completed the mapping and returned to England, becoming a career diplomat for the British. He did not ever come to Australia. Richard, my man, travelled separately by ship back to Germany with zoological specimens, both furred and feathered, dying steadily on the trip and being fed to the remaining ones. He did take back live orchids and palms and a number of plants and animals successfully, and his patrons in Berlin were very pleased. In Berlin, in the next few years, he produced his three-volume work, Ryzen in British Guiana, and we've got some displayed over there. He continued to be supported by Alexander von Humboldt, who'd also helped get the more revolutionary middle brother Otto, who didn't go to Guiana, out of prison. Otto had been a student radical. Richard lived with Otto in Berlin, and Otto helped with veterinary experiments with using a plant compound that we know as curare, which was vital in developing modern anaesthetic compounds. And getting it back from Guiana was a great coup. Richard had managed to persuade what we would call an old medicine man to let him have the recipe and some specimens. Richard was in Berlin, not living far from Potsdam, where his fiancée, my great-grandmother Paulina, lived, and I was named after her. She'd met him when she was only 16, and she waited all those years while he treks around British Guiana. And this is the, have we got the sewing cabinet? It's going to come up, I hope. There's a sewing cabinet that he made for her out of British Guiana wood, and a bead picture that she made and brought back out to Australia, and there it is. But in 1848, revolution broke out in Berlin. Otto and Richard were actively supporting radical forms, such as votes for all adult men. Reforms promised by King Frederick IV were, Wilhelm, were whittled away. The Schomburg brothers and others of a like mind were really angry and disillusioned. And also, I think there was the attraction of South Australia as a good place economically. And they formed a South Australian Colonisation Society, a group led by Otto and his friend Dr. Carl Mielke, an educator and pastor. They attracted, is one of the Mielke family here today? Yes, good, good, good. We're a very elite group. It was a great gene pool, and we've got another of the Schomburg of Otto's descendants here too. So they attracted a group of about 180 passengers for the voyage on the ship, the Princess Louise, including businessmen, professional people and skilled people, very useful in the colony, such as carpenters. It was a remarkable group. It included Carl Linger of Song of Australia fame, which many of you sang at school, the von Riebens, one of the Wiedenbach brothers, Buring of Buring and Sobels, the artist Schramm, a sculptor, a school teacher, and architects. My colleague Ian Hamstorf thinks there hasn't been another ship like it. And Humboldt's friend, the geologist Leopold von Buch, gave the brothers money, enough to build a house, we know, and they called their little settlement in Gawler Buchsfelder, after von Buch. Richard arrived in Adelaide in the spring of 1849 as a newly married young man planning to establish a farm and garden. He'd brought with him German apple trees as well as ornamental plants purchased at Rio on the way. And this is the beginning of his career as one of the most influential people to introduce plants, both utilitarian and ornamental, into Australia. Otto had been given meteorological instruments so he could make observations for scientific colleagues in Berlin. But there really were only limited, although they did keep observations very regularly, there were really only limited opportunities to carry out scientific work when you were new settlers on a farm in the Gawler district. Richard did some collecting, mostly zoological specimens like snakes and lizards, and I've got a picture of one of them in the book. And the remark, by the way, all the images are in the book, by the way, so you have to get the book to see them again. And the remarkable Otto, the older brother, worked as a journalist, as local doctor and vet, while also acting an obstetrician in the area, and he also acted as local pastor. Both brothers were active in civic affairs as the first councillors in the Muddlawarra Council. Well, Otto was actually the first chairman of the Muddlawarra Council. So here's the next clue as to Richard's later success at the Botanic Garden. As a German immigrant, you have to learn how British society operates, how you work on committees, how you deal with the government. But you also have to learn what plants will grow in this new country. You don't have generations of experience handed down from one family to another to say what plants will grow where. You have to experiment, because what they don't say in the school textbooks, and wait for it, there may be a test at the end, just about all our crop plants in Australia are introduced plants. Say it again, we'll say it again. Just about all the crop plants in Australia introduced plants, and the only things that aren't really a thing is crop plants and macadamia nuts and kwandongs, and it's not a big part of the economy. We know they had some cattle and they did some cropping. He had an orchard and vineyard, and he made quite a good wine too, and he sold plants from the nursery. So he had practical experience in growing things under local conditions and experimenting with being what we'd call an entrepreneur. Otto lived just long enough to see the first election in South Australia, dying quite young. Richard realised that he had to provide his children, now he was on his own, he'd have to provide the children with educational opportunities that they could get closer to Adelaide. There was a son named Otto, after his uncle, and five daughters to provide for. And if you think of your Jane Austen novels, this is a very important thing for a Victorian father to think, to get the girls educated, to get them into Adelaide society so they will meet suitable people. So in 1865, this was one major reason why he applied for the position as second director of Adelaide Botanic Garden. It had been established only 10 years earlier by the remarkable George William Francis. Now, can we get him up? And we'll see. In each of the capital cities in Australia, within 10 or 20 years of settlement, determined efforts were made to establish a botanic garden. It's quite a different pattern to Canada, for instance. Francis came from London, campaigned with great persistence to have a botanic garden established. Finally, in 1855, all the campaigning came to fruition. And the gardens were established. Before his premature death, Francis laid excellent foundations for the botanic garden, laying out the basic design. From the gates on, here he is, but from the gates on North Terrace, which we'll see in a minute, there's a path that defines the north-south axis, and he developed the creeks to form waterways and lakes that were an integral part of the design. And there, by the way, we can see some Wardian cases on the path, the sealed cases that Richard had very few of, to bring plants out. It keeps the sea spray and out and keeps the temperature moderately reasonable. So the glass houses were built for tropical and semi-tropical plants. And above all, he established that this was no mere pleasure garden, but an institution that provided educational and scientific service. And in Australia, there is a pattern of free admission, which there wasn't always in England. After his appointment in 1865, Schomburgk could move his family to the director's residence, which will come up in a minute. And while that's still there, you can just see one of the statues in the main front path. And the gates he put in the 1880s. Richard moves in 1865 when he starts into the director's residence. The children can go to local schools. And that old director's residence was still in use as the administrative centre as late as 1949, but sadly demolished in the 50s to make way for Royal Adelaide Hospital extensions. Now, Richard, so there we are with these lovely sort of pretty flower beds around the roses. And you can see by then some quite established trees. This is later on. This would be not as it looked when he went there. Richard, however, was in a strong position with his appointment. He had an international reputation, but he also had practical experience that came from running a farm, garden and vineyard under South Australian weather and soil conditions. He had the advantage that he was 54 with a good deal of life experience and was well-trained in the German apprenticeship system, and he had experience of local organisations in the Gawler area. The set of requests he made to the board showed that he paid attention to different facets of the work of the Botanic Garden. He wanted improvements in heating for the orchid houses and other glass houses. That would be popular with visitors who loved tropical plants, as he did. And there were to be improvements to the animal houses, which they had then, and a new aviary, which the family groups would like. He would extend the existing rose collection with a new rosary, as he called it. Definitely a popular move, and you know they grow very well in Adelaide. He would improve labelling and reorganise the herbarium. That was part of the educational and scientific role of the garden. And he'd extend the experimental ground to cater for medicinal plants, pasture plants, really important pasture plants, and plants that could be used in business and industry. A display of artificial fruit would help educate the public about suitable fruit trees to plant, and you know they grow well in Adelaide gardens. In the long term, his request for a proper experimental ground probably had the most significance in terms of the scientific and educational work. And by the way, with a rosary, look how nicely the design is, the sort of party plantings, because roses at that time only flowered a rather limited time of the year. Schomburgk grasped and the trees, we might ask me a question about the trees later. Schomburgk grasped that he needed to attract visitors to the gardens if he was going to attract funding, and thus must pay attention to popular features such as displays of orchids, animals and birds. He was back with his old friends such as tropical orchids, and it must have been very nice after the challenging years at Buchsfelder. He didn't mind being seen as a practical soul. His first outward letter in the letter book is to request permission from the city corporation to purchase manure from the city streets. That's his very first outward letter. The site was relatively flat, and there weren't the advantages that Sydney had with the harbour as the background, or Melbourne with its large site and the Yarra River, or Hobart with the hillside and river setting. He had to break up the site into smaller sections, like garden rooms. One of his early schemes was to begin plantings of avenue trees, a concept which he was well familiar with from his European background. So we get avenues such as Stoculia or Currajong, another of American ash, and plantings of the Moreton Bay figwort. It's hard to believe that what is now this iconic feature with the Moreton Bay fig started off with quite small trees in the, that we see in the picture. No, that's the parterre plantings. You can see them today. If you go along Morfitt Street towards Greenhill Road past South Terrace, and there's some quite tiny Moreton Bay figs. But this is an avenue in the European tradition, but using an Australian indigenous tree. And there's also an avenue of Pinus radiata that would be so important economically. These would take a long time to grow, however. In the meantime, he provided features such as statues, imported from places like Berlin, and brightly coloured bedding plants or feature plants in ribbon borders, as they were known, and this parterre planting. Not all botanic garden directors of his day would countenance the time and effort required by staff to achieve these results with flower beds. But these were important recreation grounds in an area with no television or films and no iPods. But what if you could provide a feature that wasn't only attractive, but stunning, newsworthy, something with a wow factor, something that would bring visitors to Adelaide from miles away? And the answer lay with the Victoria lily. The Victoria had proved hard to grow, but it was grown in England in the period 1849-1850, first by the Duke of Devonshire at Chatsworth and at the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew. Birmingham Botanic Gardens had a Victoria house by 1852, but Schomburgk left Germany in early 49, so he missed out on all this. It would require some sleuth work to establish how to grow it, the Victoria, and special funds. And you'd need to recreate as best you could the conditions under which it grew in its native Guyana, as we showed in Ian's picture of Guyana earlier on. So he'd need a water wheel. In Adelaide, it would require a special tank and some way of providing movement in the water. Schomburgk himself admitted it was quite risky because members of the government just thought it was a bit of an extravagance, and he didn't have any practical experience of growing the lily. The staff of the Botanic Gardens in Melbourne got theirs to flower first, before Victoria, Victoria and Adelaide, but they couldn't match Schomburgk's consistent success in subsequent seasons. Due to good propagation techniques, Adelaide became the only botanic garden to regularly cultivate the Victoria after 1868. Just consistently it goes on. I always say the excitement produced by what they called the vegetable wonder, or this magnificent queen of the aquatics, was comparable to excitement about Bradman's cricket scores. And similarly, people went down in their lunchtimes to have a look. One newspaper recorded over 5,000 visitors the previous Sunday. There are as many as 30,000 visitors over a four-week period. And while the 1866 census gives the population of the whole colony is only 163,000, there were about 300,000 visitors in the year. Newspapers printed hour-by-hour descriptions of the opening of the flower, and it was described as 13 inches across, or 33 centimetres, heady stuff. But not everyone was pleased, of course. There are always grumpy people writing to the newspapers. But even today, people can be disappointed. If you go on a day when the Victoria isn't flowering, or it's just flowered and it's gone all yucky, or it looks as though it might be a flower, but it's really only a bud, so you'll hear people grumbling. But basically, Schomburgk had a public relations coup. Large crowds came to the gardens. Local newspapers referred to the Victoria House effusively as a model of gracefulness, as a Sydenham palace in miniature, and his greatest undertaking to date, referring to it as a fairyland that is to be. Here they go. As the plants grew, there would be a tropical lake, embosomed in a semi-tropical forest, an epitome of the most luxuriant scenery in the world. All the art of European horticulture will be employed to display the wonders of American and Indian vegetation, wrote one of the journalists. Well, the Victoria House also had epiphytic and terrestrial orchids and other plants needing warm, humid conditions, such as croton, which we know, and Diefenbachia and Maranta. Orchids and climbers trailed across the rafters. It was a turning point. Schomburgk was still only 56 or so in 1868, and he had another 22 years to serve until he died in office in his 80th year in 1891. From now on, he could be trusted to deliver the goods. It was a huge psychological advantage, and the gardens became known as Dr. Schomburgk's Garden. It was a period when people showed a great interest in rare plants, and plant collectors went to all corners of the world collecting plants, like the Schombergs risking life and limb for their collections. There were people who spent huge amounts on rare plants. One man in Manchester in the 1830s paid over 300 guineas for a rare orchid, which is a bit like buying a Ferrari or Lamborghini today. It's just incredible. It would be a whole year's salary for quite well-placed people. In these days, before motor cars, the well-to-do citizens in Adelaide came to the Botanic Gardens to see plants that they might put in their new conservatories attached to their fine new houses. Such an interest from the public enabled the next big-ticket project. Schomburgk was now able to persuade the government to provide funds for his wonderful palm house, which still survives today after extensive restorations. He argued then that they had an extensive collection of tropical plants, probably the best in the southern hemisphere, but it was getting badly overcrowded, and improved facilities would not only save them, but add to the great prestige they already enjoyed. Persuasive stuff. But you might think, where did all these plants come from? They did purchase some from commercial nurseries, but the exchange system was really vital in building up a big and varied collection. Many people have assumed that it was just through Kew, and that Kew was the main source. But my own research showed that while Kew was indeed a major donor, places such as Beitensorg in Java and St. Petersburg in Russia were of immense importance. Beitensorg with a whole group of Dutch botanists. The surprising one is St. Petersburg, which where he's greatly dependent on a German botanist, Dr. Regel. And as it is today, it's not only what you know, but who you know. And as far as crop plants were concerned, there were important exchanges with the United States after the Civil War, in where they were building up agricultural stations. The palm house came from prefabricated from Bremen. Its purchase was made possible not only through the success of the Victoria House and the prestige it bought, but very prosperous economic conditions in the 1870s. The old Victoria House was basically a simple timber construction that they could build themselves, but the damp and heat led the structure to rot away. The new palm house that opened in the 1870s was really state-of-the-art, incorporating both new techniques in heating and ventilation and new techniques for producing iron and glass. Adelaide's old palm house is the finest Victorian glasshouse remaining in Australia and the only remaining example of this kind of German cast iron, wrought iron conservatory in the world. Outside, the waterways and lakes were steadily improved and water lilies and other aquatic plants were grown in what they called the aquarium. Here's the grotto and the palm house. And I've got a little lion image, which is in the book, showing the attractive pool and a statue that Schomburgk acquired, we'll see it in a minute, Venus arising from the sea. Apparently it collapsed when moved in the 1950s. Now, in the background, you can see the old wood museum. It quickly proved too small for exhibits, and Schomburgk began one of his campaigns, again, his persuasive powers to have a new museum, plus the prosperous times in the colony, made another big ticket possible that would have been impossible for his successor in the economically depressed 1890s. And as a result, we have the charming old Museum of Economic Botany still there today. Like the palm house, there's nothing like it in any other Australian botanic garden. It was to play a really important part in the educational and scientific role of the gardens, and although it has to be closed for a long time this year, restoration and conservation work will be done. Before it closed, we had an exhibition which included some of the images here today. And quite late in the production process for the book, we decided to increase the format and add more illustrations. It added a bit to the cost, but it meant we could reproduce some of these images. I've referred to Schomburgk establishing avenues of trees, and there was also the big project, of course, of establishing Botanic Park, providing a great recreation area much used today, but also showing what trees would grow in South Australia and what could be used by private people and in public institutions. In time, Pinus radiata became a major softwood forest plantation species. A major forest plantation species, and Schomburgk and his German colleague F.E.H.W. Krickhoff were instrumental in having legislation passed that provided for the first properly funded forest service in Australia. So like Roseworthy, it's the first of its kind, Roseworthy Agricultural College, that is, it's the first of its kind in Australia. And the contribution of people such as the German trained Schomburg, Kalmuki, Krikoff and MPF Buzzardo was pivotal in this development. The educational role of the Botanic Garden itself was enhanced by displays in the Museum of Economic Botany, and as part of it, it was hoped that manufacturers would see products made from plant materials, say such as mustard or flax or linen, and think, well, maybe we could make that here. And then they hoped that farmers might see the display and wonder if they could try new crops such as, say, mustard seed or flax. And the farmers might also look at the display of pasture grasses, which are very important economically, or the display on noxious weeds. There was also a display, by the way, on Aboriginal use of plants for medicinal purposes, provided by Paul Filsher from the Northern Territory. Schomburg knew from Guyana that Indigenous people had a special knowledge of plants and special uses for them. But to our knowledge, there wasn't anything like this being displayed in the museum that became the South Australian Museum at the time. And it's a nice touch for those of us who occasionally need an anaesthetic that Schomburg had a sample of curare too in the museum. Now, I mentioned the crop plants, and this was really important work. Crop plants that would be suitable for the South Australian climate. Now, by this time, the Botanic Gardens is a sort of multi-purpose institution that carried out research that today and later would be was done by the Roseworthy College, the Department of Agriculture, now PIRSA, the Waite Institute and the CSIRO. So they had trials of pasture grasses, crop plants such as canola, which they called rape, which has turned out a great success, lentils, and then three of special importance, sultana vines, which he introduced, phylloxera free rootstock, so we didn't get phylloxera in South Australia, and wheat varieties that were really influential in breeding good varieties for Australia. And here we have, in a minute, yes, the experimental ground where a lot of this research was carried out. Again, it means using your contacts all over the world. Now, I keep stressing the balanced approach that was the Schomburg trademark and why I call him the diplomatic gardener. Two classic examples of directors not getting on with their political masters in colonial Australia. Firstly, Gerhard Kreft in the Australian Museum in Sydney. He was dismissed and locked himself up and wouldn't leave. The other was Ferdinand von Müller, Schomburg's German contemporary in Melbourne. Such a clever, hardworking man, an infinitely better taxonomist than Schomburg, but not good at keeping the government and the public happy. Like the famous botanist Hooker at Kew, he thought paying lots of attention to attractive displays was a waste of a busy botanist's time. Von Müller established his class ground, where plants are organised according to Botanical Farm quite early on, in neat, tidy lines. Schomburg realised that this wouldn't be to the average person's taste. He waited until he had achievements like the display in the Victoria House behind him, and meanwhile grew avenues of trees beside the planned location. And there we are. And it's a bit dull, you have to admit, but you can see the palm house in the background. Von Müller was in time ousted as director of Melbourne Botanic Gardens, although he stayed on as a much-respected botanist working next door, but he never set foot in the gardens again. As we saw, Schomburg's original training as a gardener taught him to work with a client and pace his work to fit in with client expectations. The reward was that Adelaide Botanic Garden became the best-funded colonial botanic garden in Australia in terms of funding per head of population. And as I said, the gardens were known as Dr. Schomburg's Garden, and he wrote later in life he had become the people's pet. Very much under the shadow of two able older brothers and frequently confused with Robert even today, he came into his own in middle age, a comfort for us all. When you think of our ageing population, it's comforting to know that he began his successful Botanic Gardens career in his mid-50s and worked until his 80th year. In many ways, he benefited from the fact that in colonial Australia, a practical man and a practical approach was highly valued. He doesn't seem to have been disadvantaged by being a person of German origin in Anglo-Australian society. People respected scientific and technical training for one thing, and he was active in mainstream groups. The family attended the Anglican Church of St Paul's in Pulteney Street. And unlike the bachelor Ferdinand von Müller in Melbourne, he didn't wear eccentric clothes, and if you have five daughters, they'll put you straight pretty quickly anyway. And Apropos parents and children, Richard's parents must have done a pretty good job to produce four very talented sons. As well as Robert, Otto and Richard, there was also the remarkable Julius, one of the best colonial silversmiths in Australia. But above all, success came not only from good fortune, but being practical and good-natured, having a sense of humour, respecting different groups in society, being able to work with them, and being a plantsman, someone who loves plants for their own sake.